In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. When Father Daniel asked me to speak about prison ministry, I was a little confused, and I'm sure you are too, so we're just going to roll with it. I'm going to really use this as an excuse or as a way to segue into practical theology, which is really all that I care about, the meaning of life, how to live, and marriage. So, yes, I will connect prison ministry with marriage, and we'll see if you think I did a good job or not. How I got into prison ministry, about 18 years ago, somebody came to church. They were friends of parishioners. He was a friend of parishioners. And after the service, I sat underneath a hackberry tree and talked with him for 5 hours about everything. He was a very troubled young man, lots of things going on. The one thing he didn't tell me was going on was that he was wanted for a crime, which he turned himself in for on Wednesday, the following Wednesday. And then I followed him into the Fort Worth jail, started talking to him. He wasn't Orthodox, but he'd come into my life, so I started talking to him. Eventually, he was convicted. He went to prison. So I went down to prison to see him, which was 3 hours away. And I talked on a phone like, you know, in prison movies, you know, when you pick up the phone and everything. And that's a terrible way to interface with somebody. So I thought, I got to find some different way. So I found out that I could be a volunteer chaplain and have what's called contact visits, which means you're in a room with him and doing whatever you do. Praying, giving them a blessing, having communion, confession, just normal stuff without a screen between you and him. Eventually, I saw that he wanted to be baptized, catechized him, and he was baptized. When he was baptized, two guys showed up because the prison grapevine told them about me. One of them was already Orthodox. The other one had prayed for, I think it was 2 years, for a priest to come. So lo and behold, here I am. So I catechized him, and he was eventually baptized. Other people came in. I found out through them about another prison where there were people, called them up, got permission to visit, started visiting them. So now, through talking with one boy underneath a hackberry tree, that's gone now, by the way, it's a football field, so there's no evidence whatsoever, it's gone, just like things in the world go away. But what didn't go away is his resolve to eventually become Orthodox, and now a prison ministry where I write to about 40 people, and I baptize about 12, and I have probably 5 catechumens, go to 3 different prisons, 2 on one day, Wednesday, and 2 on and 1 on another Wednesday, and I go to each set of prisons twice, so I see the guys twice a month. I serve liturgy once a month in each one of the prisons, and then I do teaching or whatever they need the other time. So that's basically what's happening. It just happened because I talked with a guy underneath a hackberry tree, had no idea what was going to happen. So that leads me to the principles of prison ministry. So I want you to think not prison ministry, but really life, because these are principles of life that I've learned through being a pastor. And really, I should have learned them before I was a pastor, but I'm a slow learner, and I've learned them over the course of years. The first principle of prison ministry is pray. And it might seem obvious to you, it might seem silly to say that, but I didn't always know that. I didn't always pray. Oh, I said my morning and evening prayers and my pravila and stuff like that. But I didn't pray by name for everybody in my ministry every single day. That's full disclosure, I didn't do it. I didn't know to do it. I just learned that I can't do anything, really, nothing. Only with Christ can we do anything. And so I learned that the most important thing I do as a human being, and also as a human being who's a priest, is pray for the people that I encounter. So I'm going to write all your names down, get all your names from Father Daniel. I've already started praying for some of you. Unfortunately, I don't remember everybody's name, so I've got to get them all written down. And pray for you in the liturgy and also in my daily prayers. I've learned to pray. I want you to learn from my mistakes. Don't do it the hard way. Learn to pray. Pray for the people that are in your life, both the good ones and the bad ones, especially the bad ones, especially the hard ones. Pray for them every day, not just your morning and evening prayers, if you say them, not just the Psalter, if you say it. That's wonderful if you do. I would recommend it. But pray for people. That is the most critical part of prison ministry and life and marriage and everything else. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how to do it, practical things about how to pray. I suppose this is marginally related to prison ministry, but I'm taking some dramatic license. So first of all, get some diptychs. The word means list. List them down. I put them on my computer, upload it to Dropbox, then I can have it on my phone. And most of the time, I read it off my phone because it's very convenient, very easy. It's right in my hand. And even though I'm at home most of the time I read it, it's always updated, no matter what. So write them down, everybody that you should pray for. And who should be on that list? Certainly your parents and your brothers and sisters, your priest, and the people you don't get along with, the people you don't like, the people that have done you wrong. If anybody's hurt you, I don't care how terribly, you must pray for them. That's an absolute requirement for your spiritual well-being and for theirs. You can't get better. You cannot forgive somebody unless you pray for them. It is impossible. So how do you pray for them? I remember when I was, for my short period of time, I was a Protestant years ago, and people would say, I'll be in prayer for you. And I always wondered, what does that mean? I had no idea what they were really meaning. I think it meant, I'm going to say something nice to you and then I'm going to forget about it. But when I say I'm going to pray for you, I write your name down and I pray for you. And this is generally how I do it, any one of these three different ways, mostly the Jesus prayer. So you can say, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon Emmanuel. And if you really want to pray for Emmanuel a lot, then pray 10 times on your chotki, or 100 times, or 33 times, or 50 times, or 40 times, or however big your chotki is. And pray for each one of them like that. Sometimes I pray the prayer of St. Siloam of Manathos that I got from a talk. It is, I pray thee, O merciful Lord, for all the peoples of the world, that they may know thee by the Holy Spirit. I think that's a perfect all-inclusive prayer. Sometimes I pray that. So, you know, you just insert the name. And there's an old believer prayer from the Old Believer Prayer Book that I added one line to that I really like, that occasionally I use for a little emphasis. Most of the time I pray the Jesus Prayer, but sometimes you just, psychologically, maybe you need to do something different, and this is something different. In fact, I'm going to hand it out to you afterwards as a little card to go in your prayer book, which I'm sure every single one of you has. So it begins, Save, O God, have mercy upon thy servant, John. Deliver him from every tribulation, wrath, and need, from every sickness of soul and body. Forgive him every transgression, voluntary and involuntary. And my addition, because this is my whole deal in life, this is all I care about, is that living according to purpose. Teach them to pray and to live with purpose and do whatever is profitable to save our souls. So you could do that for each one of your family, your friends, your enemies, if you wanted to do a little longer prayer. Now, as far as results, I can tell you honestly, I don't know of any incidents in my life when my prayer caused something to happen. I don't know. Because somebody else might have been praying for that person. And I don't really take great stock in my prayers, to be honest. I take great stock when I pray before the altar, because I'm a priest. Despite my sins, I pray before the altar, and the Lord is inclined to hear as priests. But when I pray other than that, I sort of have feeling that I'm unworthy, but I got to do it anyway. So don't look for results, because what prayer is, or should be, and is becoming for me, and I want it to become for you, is experiencing God. To be in God's presence. That's what prayer really is. It's not rattling off the trisagion. It is to be in God's presence. That is what prayer is. That is the hardest thing you'll do and the greatest thing you'll ever do. So don't look for results per se, that you pray for somebody and they no longer are sick, or a situation gets better, or anything like that. Just pray because love constrains you to pray. You should pray because there should be something inside you that says, I got to do it. I can't do anything good for this person except pray for them. That's the best I can do for them. Perhaps you can do other things that are good. So that's the first principle of prison ministry, and I think you'll agree, of life, to pray and to work on it. You got to work on it because it doesn't come naturally for us. I'm a priest. It didn't come naturally for me, and most of the people that I encounter, it doesn't come naturally for them. So work at it. Then the other principle is just do it. It's not just what's on a shoe. It is the way to live your life. Just do it. And there's a certain aggressiveness that has to be in your life. In prison ministry, if you're not aggressive, you're lost. You're not going to get done what you need to get done. You have to be aggressive in prison ministry. You have to be aggressive in life. I'm not talking about any where you're confrontative. I'm talking about aggressiveness in that you're going to pray, you're going to work, you're just not going to give up. And in order to just do it, you need to notice stuff. You need to see what's going on around you. You need to look outside of yourself and see the world, see people, and see when people are suffering, when people are sinning, when people are struggling. And you need to take that in. And then you need to do what your heart tells you to do. What does your heart tell you to do? You've got to know that. You've got to learn to listen to your heart. Your heart should tell you. My heart tells me all the time. I've encountered many of you, and although I'm pretty shy and haven't talked to each one of you personally, that's one of my personal failings, I've noticed things, and my heart has noticed them. And my heart tells me, I got to pray for you. So there's an aggressiveness that has to be with noticing things. Also, just do it means be flexible. Prison ministry flexibility is really king. I'll tell you a little story, quick little story. I wanted to serve liturgy. They had this rule, you couldn't bring alcohol in. For a long time, they said, no, you can't bring alcohol in. Part of it was because they didn't know who I was. They thought, who is this guy? I was classified as other for a long time. There was Roman Catholic, there was Protestant, there was Seventh-day Adventist, there was Sabbatarian, and I was other. They didn't know what to call me. Seriously. And finally, they figured out to call me Eastern Orthodox or Russian Orthodox or Greek Orthodox. I'm called three different things. And they understood that we serve the liturgy like the Catholics do, more or less. And I got permission to bring alcohol in. And then I was stubborn. I was stupid because they said they cannot have anything from that alcohol. They can't. You can go ahead and consecrate, but you cannot give it to them from your chalice. I'm thinking, well, that's what we do. We serve the liturgy, and then we give communion from the chalice. And so I was stubborn about it. I'm thinking, I'm not going to give them the reserve sacrament. We're celebrating the liturgy. You know what? I started giving them the reserve sacrament. And I took too long to come to that decision. You have to be flexible. There's no dogma that says you can't give the reserve sacrament during divine liturgy. This is prison. This is different. You got to do what you got to do. So I've learned to be flexible. Also, I want to tell you about that prayer for patience. And each one of you have said it, right? You say it in the prayer of St. Ephrem. So whether you meant it or not, you said it. And I'm telling you, God heard that prayer. He heard that prayer. That's a dangerous prayer. Very dangerous prayer. It's only one way to become patient. You know the way? Have stuff that makes you impatient. It's the only way. It's the only way. Prison ministry helps you with that. I'm telling you, you can get a lot of stuff that makes you impatient. I've gone down to one particular prison 8 different times now and not been allowed to see my guys. I probably altogether, between all the prisons I've gone to, at least probably a dozen or maybe even 15, maybe even 20 times, not been able to see them because of some reason. After I've already gone there, after I've already called to find out that I could come, etc., something happened. There weren't enough guards, there was a fight, whatever. And I just drove 3 hours. You can learn patience. So here's a third principle. 90% of life is just showing up. I learned that in prison ministry especially. Because I'm not a particularly organized guy. I've talked with Father Daniel about this. I'm a bear with very little brain when it comes to being organized. I have an incompetent secretary, disobedient and lazy, and loses things. And it's very frustrating to me. So sometimes I'd go down to prison. I wouldn't have any idea what I was going to talk to him about. So I'd bring a Bible in my hand or a Lenten Triodion. No idea what I was going to talk to him about. But what they needed was me. They didn't need my Bible knowledge. They didn't need me to talk about Great Lent or Transfiguration or something. I might have done that. They needed me. They needed me to say, I love you because I've come to see you. So I just showed up. 90% of my work was done by showing up. And that is true in life. Now, showing up is not just being in someone's presence. Showing up is thinking about other people. You can think of it metaphorically too. You got to be there for people, not abandon people. You don't have to be smart. You know, as a priest, I learned when people would, somebody would die, what do you say to people? You just be there for them. Don't have to be smart. I don't have to be smart in prison ministry. I don't have to be smart in ministry. I just have to care. I have to be there, and I have to pray. I can do those things. So 90% of my job is done, and it will be done for you too if you just show up for the things you're supposed to show up for. So the fourth principle of prison ministry is whatever crosses your path. This works for disorganized people especially, because half the time I don't know what I'm going to do next. But whatever crosses my path, that's what I'm going to do. So this young man who came to me, and I talked to him underneath a hackberry tree, I've got 20 years of prison ministry, or 18 years of prison ministry now, just because he came by. So whatever crosses my path, I'm going to do. And that applies real well to marriage, by the way. We'll talk about it in a minute. This makes your life really easy. You don't have to be real smart. You don't have to figure out some great thing to do. You might be great at organizing things or whatever. That's great if you are. If you have those gifts, well, slava Bogu. But I don't have those gifts. I just know how to react to stuff, and then I might start doing some planning after that because God has said, you got to do this. And it also takes away your self-will. It's a way of being obedient. It's a really wonderful book. I don't know if I'm going to get the person right in the book, but it's called Everyday Saints, and I believe it was Bishop Basil, and he had this rule for himself. He had one rule. Whatever somebody tells him to do, he'll do it. I don't know if you've read that book. You should. It's fantastic. That is a great rule. Whatever crossed his path, he did. Even if it was a really outlandish request, he did it. That's a great way to live your life, because then you're obeying everybody. And by the way, we obey you. Did you know that? A priest must obey his parishioners. You know, you think of a priest or a bishop, Vladika, as being in authority over you. That's not the way he thinks of it. That's not the way I think of it. You're an authority over us. Your needs are what tell me what to do. So what your needs are, they cross my path, I better deal with them. Now, it's important not to miss anything if you're going to have this kind of ministry. I'm going to tell you one of my favorite scriptures. Father Nicholas has heard it a million times. It's not a happy scripture. It's about the Gergesenes. Remember when the demoniacs went out of the men and went into the pigs? And then the pigs went down and were choked in the Lake of Galilee? And then the people came who were the keepers of the pigs, the owners of the pigs, and they were afraid and they said, leave us. And he did. The light was shining. And they told him to go away. And what was it like the next day? Well, the next day they found a way to get more pigs. And they went on living. And they didn't know what they'd missed. How many times have you and I missed something that the Lord wanted us to do something? And we missed it, either because we were too proud, or too self-centered, or too tired, or just ignorant. So you got to open your eyes. I'll tell you something about opening your eyes. When you look at other people, I'm not talking about to judge them, but I'm talking about to have compassion upon them, to care about them. Your problems are not as big because you're caring for others, because God enlarges your heart. And the things that bother you, they're not as big. I'm telling you, it works every time. Let's talk about prison ministry and marriage. And you think, that doesn't really roll off the tongue, does it? But it really applies. Because I'm trying to tell you about life right now. I'm not trying to recruit anybody for prison ministry right now. I'm trying to recruit you for living according to the purpose of your life. That's all I care about. So let's talk about marriage. Real quickly, what's marriage for? Salvation of the soul. We've been through this in some of the other talks. To learn to love as God loves. God is love, we know that. He is three similar hypostases or persons loving one another, right? Because the Father is God, the Son is God, and the Spirit is God, and they love each other perfectly. And marriage is two dissimilar persons. Not only dissimilar in that they're separate human beings, but one is male and one is female. And that's different. That's a lot different. And it's learning to love each other perfectly. And that's what will teach you to love God. If you get married and you do it right, then you'll learn to love God. because you'll learn to love somebody who's not quite like you, but they are like you, and to become one with them, and then you learn to love God. So, the principles I would say in prison ministry that I want to focus on that apply to marriage, of course, prayer applies to everything, but we'll talk primarily about whatever crosses your path, just do it, and 90% of life is showing up. I want to tell you what I discovered in my first year of marriage. I discovered I wasn't such a nice guy. I was surprised. I love my wife dearly. I found out I wasn't such a nice guy. I found out that there were times when I didn't want to do it her way, when I didn't want to do what she wanted to do, when I wanted to be left alone, when I didn't like the way things were going. I wasn't such a nice guy. That's what I learned. I think in the second year I was a little bit nicer guy. And I think I've gotten nicer as I've gone along, but I still don't think I'm a nice guy. But that's really what marriage taught me. It was really like hitting a wall. We had no big arguments and everything. We had no great conflicts. But I just saw that, wow, I really want to live for myself and not for somebody else. So it taught me a lot about that I wasn't a nice guy. You learn to compromise with another human being. You learn to put another human being first. You learn to give your will to another. Now, I hope you know the scripture in Ephesians that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people sometimes get upset about. It says it quite clearly. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And it also says, husbands, love your wives. But what sometimes I would dare say men don't understand is that if you love your wife, you will submit to her. If you love your wife, you'll be obedient to her. Obedient to her needs. That's very critically important. The wife should be obedient to the needs of the husband, and the husband to the needs of the wife. Whatever those needs are, physical, spiritual, if you want to say such a thing as psychological, to be obedient to their needs. I'll give you some examples. Unfortunately, I only have bad ones that I learned from. But I think sometimes the bad ones, you learn from the bad things you do, especially if you get better from them. So, my wife wanted to buy a couch early in our marriage. If you see my office, you'll see that I don't care much about couches. I don't care much about furniture. And I never have. But she did. I didn't consider it frivolous or anything like that. We had enough money. It just wasn't important to me. So she wants to go shopping for a couch, and it's like, I didn't care about a couch. And I finally figured out, after I saw that she was kind of hurt over it, let's go shopping for a couch. Let's buy a couch. So we bought a couch, a nice purple couch with yellow flowers, had it for many, many years. And that was something I learned from that couch. Just do it. Just do it. My wife wanted a couch. Buy the doggone couch. That's it. I mean, it might sound silly, you're laughing about it, but this is a real important life lesson for me. My wife wanted a couch. I didn't care about a couch, but she did, which means I should have cared about a couch. So we bought a couch. Talking about our day, I'll give you another bad example. My wife is not an extremely verbal woman. But being a less verbal woman means she's more verbal than me. That's for sure. It's a difference between the sexes, let's be honest. For the most part, it's usually true. So, we'd come home and she wanted to know about my day. So I tell her in like two sentences. I had a good day. It was great. I couldn't think of anything else. It's completely unimportant to me. I didn't even remember what I did. I couldn't even tell her what I had for lunch. Then I would say, how was your day? And she would tell me in intimate detail for perhaps 2 hours about her day. And I got bored, and I got restless, and I hurt her by not being engaged with her. And I basically didn't follow the principle of 90% of life is showing up, and also just do it. She needed it, so listen to her. Now, she learned over time to sort of be a little bit, edit things a little bit more. But I learned to listen to her because I love my wife. Why would I want to hurt my wife by saying, man, I'm tired of this? That's not right. So I learned to listen to her when she talked about things. And to this day, If she asks me about something, I'm going to probably tell her two or three sentences. And I've improved. Maybe I'm up to 10 sentences now. But she's going to tell me more. And that's okay. This is not a criticism of the way I talk or the way she talks. It's that we're different and we have to be obedient to each other's needs. One more bad example about visiting the family. My family and I, we loved each other, but we weren't particularly incredibly close. We weren't estranged or anything, but it didn't really occur to me that I wanted to go and spend my summer vacation with them. I just didn't want to do it. She wanted to be with her folks on summer vacation because they were in Florida and far away, and so she wanted to be with them every year. And I didn't, I loved her folks, I still love her folks, but I didn't want to always take every vacation with them. And so sometimes she went alone, and it hurt her. And sometimes I dragged my feet about it, and it hurt her. And I was stupid. I should have just gone. Because that's what she needed. That's what she wanted. She wasn't being selfish. That was just one of her things. So I learned to be obedient to her needs. Now, do you see how prison ministry and marriage and life and a priesthood are basically all the same thing? You got to be there for people. You got to show up. When your heart tells you to do something, do it. And whatever comes into your life, whatever crosses your path, the needs of your wife, the problems of a friend, somebody meeting you on the street, a homeless person, whatever it is, well, God is telling you, you got to deal with that person right then and there. You got to do something about it. That person has crossed your path. I'm going to tell you a few prison ministry stories, because they're kind of interesting. I don't have any really incredibly, you know, bizarre stories. I wish I did. It'd be really cool, you know, like if there was a riot or something, you know. And I've never been in a riot. But I'll tell you a few things. There was one time when I wondered whether or not I was going to get in a fight. Actually, there were two times. So this is one of the times. There was this guy. He was like about 6'4". He looked like he could handle himself. He'd probably been in, you know, 300 prison fights. And he was not Orthodox. And he came to our services. And he really liked me, and he said, I want to go to confession. So I said, yes. Wait a minute, you don't give confession to people who are not Orthodox? Well, sure, you can counsel them. I mean, there's no rule against that. So I did it. So we're in this room by ourselves, and he's starting to talk to me. And there's something called reflective listening that really smart people know about. You learn it in nursing school like I did. You might learn it in you know, different psychological counseling courses and maybe even in the seminary. Reflective listening. That's like you say something to me and I reflect back what you're saying so you know that I'm engaged and I understand what you mean. Right? It's a very good thing to do. And people who are good listeners do it naturally. So he's talking to me and he's talking about some sort of racist thing. He was a boy from the backwoods of East Texas and he didn't like black people at all. And so he was talking about it, and he understood that his opinion was wrong. But then he was getting really riled up about it, talking about incidents that really bothered him. And that's not a good thing to do in confession, right? You don't want to get riled up about the thing you're saying that's a sin. You want to not be angry about it. So I said to him, well, Jay, it seems like you're upset about this. And he said, no, I'm not. And he went on and got more upset. So then I, using my reflective listening skills, said to him, but Jay, the tone of your voice makes it appear that you're upset. He stood up, all 6'4" of him, and I thought he was going to come right at me. The look on his face was one of absolute anger. So I literally stood with my chair, and I was thinking this in my head. I got to be like a lion tamer. I was going to put the chair between me and him, and I was going to try to get the attention of people. And I figured, I was really doing the arithmetic. I was figuring I had 30 seconds before he really took me apart. Because I'm not a weakling, but I sure don't know how to fight. So I figured I could probably hold out for 30 seconds. But all he did was open the door and march out of the room. And I didn't see him again that day. So I'll tell you what I did when I got home. And this is why I'm telling you the story. I didn't do anything wrong. I said, it appears you're angry. In a nice tone of voice like that. I wasn't accusing him. I was trying to interface with him. I was trying to have a dialogue with him. He didn't want any of it. What I did is immediately I wrote a letter and apologized to him and asked his forgiveness for offending him. He wrote back to me and said he was very happy that he said that I said that and that I acknowledged that I offended him, because otherwise he would have never come back. So he came back. Now, I don't quite agree with his version of events, but you know what? That doesn't matter. What matters is he came back. And I still write to him to this day. Now, he is transferred to another prison. I haven't seen him in a long time. But I still write to him to this day. I'll tell you about D and the white guy. These are pseudonyms, by the way. I try not to say their names to let them be have privacy. So D is a black guy, and the white guys come into his cell because they move people around constantly to keep them disoriented in prison. At least it seems to be that they do it for that reason. I can't understand another reason. So the white guy was super racist, and he started saying all kinds of epithets towards him as he was going in the cell. So they hated each other. The white guy wouldn't sleep on the bunk because it was tainted by the black guy, right? Because D's on the top bunk, so that bunk is now poison. It's dirty. He wouldn't sleep on it, so he slept on the floor. Well, D knew that when it rained, the water would flow down the wall and would make the entire wall and the floor wet right where he was sleeping. You think he told him? No. He's thinking it serves him right. So when it rained, 2 a.m, all of a sudden this guy's sopping wet, cold. D wakes up, and then something just came over him. And he said, hey, you can have my other bedroll here. He had some other linen. He said, you can take it. And the guy said, really? Yeah, you can take it. So he took it, slept on the bunk bed, and they became friends. See? I think that's pretty amazing. I'll tell you about Kimmy. That's another pseudonym. Kimmy was a gigantic, 6'8", well over 300 pounds, flaming gay black man. Now, when I mean flaming in the prison, there are people that I want you to understand how people hurt, okay? He was out there. He made himself an object for people. And he acted flaming in order to get attention. He was also very aggressive. It may or may not have really been his sexual orientation, but he was just out there to get attention, and he debased himself because of his feelings about himself. He was a broken human being. Well, same guy I talked with you just a few minutes ago, Jay, was in his pod, and it was kind of open. Have you ever seen Cool Hand Luke? It was kind of like that. So Kimmy would always swear at him and curse at him. And Jay really hated that. Jay would talk to me about it. I'd say, Jay, you got to pray for this guy. And he did start praying for him. And then one day something remarkable happened. Kimmy, despite the fact that he acted like he didn't care about anything, and he just hated people, he just wanted to cuss and everything, he had family. And something had gone wrong outside of prison. And he needed to contact somebody, but he didn't have a stamp and he didn't have a letter. And he needed to do it now. And Jay found out about it and said, here's a stamp. Here's some paper. Just a random act of kindness. But it wasn't random, because he had been prepared for it because he was praying for him. So his heart was changing. And from that point on, Kimmy and Jay, they weren't friends per se, but they were acquaintances who got along. You know, how you doing? Good morning. You know, maybe even sharing some coffee once in a while, something like that, right? They didn't hang out with each other, but they were not enemies anymore. And he still swore at other white guys, but he didn't swear at Jay, okay? Later on, he's just gotten out of prison. I never met Kimmy, but he just got out of prison, my guys told me. And he actually had stopped being angry towards whites and cursing at whites all the time, and had developed some relationship with white people. Could that be because Jay started praying for him, and because of that, Jay's heart changed? Because of that, Jay gave him a stamp? Could it be just because of that? I think so. I'll talk to you about Willie. I'm going to read you a letter from him in a minute. He's just the salt of the earth. Willie is an old black man. Found out he was 63. I swear he looked like he was 80. Because he'd had a hard life. Seriously. And he was a Baptist. And he would come to the services. And when I would talk about scripture, he'd nod his head when everybody didn't have any idea what I was talking about. He knew his scripture. He knew his Bible. And he was very respectful. And when he talked, he had this quality that when he started talking, everybody shut up. Because everybody wanted to hear what he had to say. Because he had a wisdom about him. Man's been in prison for 30 years, but he had a certain wisdom about him, a certain gentleness about him, a certain kindness about him. So he'd tell me all the time, he's the only one who gets away with this, don't you try it. He'd say, Father Holland, I love your services, but I'm a Baptist, I'll always be a Baptist. Tell me that all the time. And then somehow he transitioned to calling me Father Seraphim. I'm not sure when. And then just a few months ago, he wrote me a letter that said, Father Seraphim, please baptize me. I got to be baptized. So it just so happened I came to this prison the next day that after I read his letter, and I said, absolutely, I'm going to baptize you. Now, this is where you kind of just do it, okay? According to the sort of the principle of the thing, you're supposed to catechize and everything. This is an old man. I thought he was 80. He was 63, so I thought I probably had more years than I thought. But he's on half a lung. One of his lungs is gone because of lung cancer. And I've seen more Christianity in this man's little finger than I've seen in an awful lot of other people, their whole body. So the next time I baptized him, I'm going to tell you about his baptism. Now, you might laugh about this. This might seem funny or whatever. But I'm just going to tell you, this is kind of stuff that happens in prison. You just got to roll with it. Okay? So they had a jumper that they would change into in order to be baptized. Full immersion. Okay? We had baptismal fonts. We have them in every prison. Thank God for the Baptists. They have baptismal fonts in every single prison. And so I'm hearing his life confession. And he wants to change into the jumper. We only have so much time. We got to move along. So he's changing into the jumper. And suddenly I'm confessing a buck naked man. Just like that. I'm thinking, okay. It's not the only thing that's been different in prison, so I just rolled with it. But I'll tell you something about him. When he was baptized, he was trembling. I've never seen somebody tremble before like that. It really meant it. He really cleaved to Christ. And you'll see in his letter in a minute how much he did. There was a guy once that ran up to me. When people run to you in prison, you start to think complicated thoughts. So I was alone. I was walking towards a building, and it just so happens no guards were near me or anything. So I was alone, and this guy starts running towards me full speed. So I get in a crouch, literally, in a crouch, and I'm thinking, okay, you know. And he literally came up to me and stopped just short of my nose. You ever seen those pictures where a baseball manager is arguing with the umpire, and he turns the bill of his hat, and they're nose to nose? You ever seen that? There's a famous picture that Norman Rockwell did. And so he was just like that. He was nose to nose, touching my nose, saying, are you a Wiccan? And I said, well, actually, no, I'm a priest. And then he wanted to know my doctrine, because people want to know doctrine in Texas. So I told him some of my doctrine. And then that segued into the fact that the man was incredibly depressed. He was contemplating suicide. He basically had a plan how he was going to do it. And I talked him down from it. Wrote him letters and have seen him infrequently since, but he's doing much better. All because he thought I was a Wiccan.
What's a
Wiccan? A Wiccan is like a they worship the sun and moon. It's, you can call them a witch. They're nature worshipers. Okay? It's pagan. Okay? Speaking of, well, he just saw me like this and he just didn't know. So, speaking of pagan, I'm going to tell you how I once told somebody to use something pagan in a Christian way. Now, you don't learn about this in seminary, folks, at all. If I brought it up in seminary, I'm sure I would get in big trouble. But here's what happened. Somebody very dear to me, I'm going to call him Will, I baptized him, and he was serious, but he had a lot of setbacks. He had some losses. Some people died outside of prison that he couldn't go to their funerals. He was punished for something that truly wasn't his fault. He was later exonerated, but he was put in solitary confinement because of it. I went to visit him there. And I'm telling you, there was so much despair, so much evil in the air, I was shaking when I left. And he was there for 3 months. So I tried to tell him to pray, and I kept seeing him and everything, but he kind of lost his mind. And he just gave up. Said, that's it, I'm done, I'm not coming anymore. But I would go to see him and talk to him. And he always was happy to see me. I didn't really talk to him particularly about religion. I just was there. So I got 90% of my work done by just sitting down on a picnic bench with him. And I was telling him, you need to pray. You need to pray the Jesus prayer again. He says, I can't do it anymore because I gave away my prayer robe. Well, he had become the head of the pagans in the prison. He was formerly involved in Satanism. In fact, you're going to hear a letter from him in a minute. He didn't believe any of the pagan stuff, but he had to do something. You know, he didn't know what to do with himself. So he was wearing a big pagan amulet. I don't know what this thing had, a goat or something. But it had beads. So I said, use that. Just use the beads. And he did. I told him to use a pagan amulet to say the Jesus prayer. How's about that for cognitive dissonance? Huh? All right. Let's read some letters. This is a letter from Sam, we'll say. And I had asked the guys if they would be willing to write to you something about what the prison ministry, the Orthodox prison ministry, has meant to them. They could write anything they wanted. And here's what S. Sam wrote. Thank you again for your tireless love and devotion for all of us who are incarcerated. Seldom do I feel the true love of our God in this place, so it is such a joy to know I am loved when I am at the Orthodox services. Although I'm not Orthodox, I enjoy your service more than any other because God is real to me when I'm there. You ask us today to write about how Orthodox service has affected us individually so that you can share it with your prison ministry youth talk. This has weighed heavily on me since you left because of the importance. First and foremost, I expect others will say that the youth should learn from their past mistakes because this is not a place to spend their lives or his past mistakes. I'm not going to do that. I was one of those youth who was told by many others not to follow in their footsteps, and this caused me to go down paths that I had to travel to become what I am today. I'm not saying to ignore good advice, but we all have to choose our paths in life. It is the outcome of those choices that determines our destiny. For me, the destiny was to come here to prison so that I could learn the love of God. My whole life, I could not feel or understand what love was. I rarely felt I was loved by my parents, so I thought to gain attention from anyone, usually in a negative way. Coming in and out of prisons across the country in 3 different states, and now Texas, was the result of my acting out. I'm now 50-something years old with no children. I felt for years that I would die alone, and that was the end of things. Today, although I struggle with everyday things in life, I know that I'm loved by God. I'm not alone. I sought him out. He has always been there. Some say that my life is hopeless. I have said it for years. So be it. I have made the choices in life and now face the consequences of those choices. The difference now is that I know I am loved and God is never going to leave me alone. Because I finally realize this, I surround myself with those who God sends my way for comfort. It is for this reason and for many others that I continue to attend the Orthodox service. I see God in everything you say and do, and I now can see that God has wanted me for what God has wanted for me my whole life, peace. Thank you for always being you and sharing the love of God constantly in both word and deed. May God's will be done through our humble prayers always. I used to call him Eeyore. Now I call him Tigger. Seriously. He was so cynical all the time. And now he's not cynical anymore. Maybe he'll become Orthodox. I don't know. This is from the guy who I told to pray the Jesus prayer with the pagan amulet. We'll call him Jack. Dear Father Seraphim, I'm writing in response to your request of 1125. For me, since becoming part of the Orthodox Church, I have become whole. Despite the setbacks I placed myself through, I have found a home. When I lost many family members due to illness, the Church helped me survive by never giving up. And your continued love and support as my priest and friend has kept me sane, even when I fought against it. This is what the blessings of the Church have meant to me. I hope this will help with your talk. I also want to write some things, included, that I hope you'll be able to use in your ministry if you have troubled youngsters. If my writing helps even one youngster in trouble, then I feel that I have done what God put me here for. I've spoken several times of becoming either a monk or a priest, I don't know if that'll happen, but I do hope that I can help someone avoid the traps I've fallen into. I hope that the following will open the door to show what you as a young person sees as a one-way ride. I was just like you, or at least facing the same things. I know you have heard that before, and believe me, I had to, but really I have. I was a young man raised in a single-parent home, started drinking at 12, tried weed at 13, was headed to prison for murder at 17. I was a gangbanger who honestly did not care. I did not want to live to see 30 or even 20. I saw the streets as my home and drugs as my life. I was practicing Satanism. I thought to live was to be evil, as they have the same letters. and they're each other spelled backwards. There was no sin I wouldn't try once or generally twice. Then came two occurrences that changed my life. My girlfriend became pregnant and I killed a 16-year-old boy. I should say three occurrences, but prison proved not that different than I was living before with drugs and gangs, etc. When my son was born, I began wanting to live. But I didn't know how. That was 1992. I spent years down in the same cycle, and then in 2007, I met Father Seraphim, who has been teaching me to live ever since. Then he goes on to give you a few scriptures to read, and he says, God is the only chance any of us have for happiness and freedom. He's been listening, because I say that kind of stuff all the time. And then he said also, something that I say all the time too, there's nothing that God cannot or will not forgive us for, and there is nothing that will make him stop loving us. Okay, last letter is from Willie. I wish you could meet Willie. He's just wonderful. He's a very simple man. He's very smart, but he's not educated. And he's a country boy. And so he writes like a country boy. I tried to preserve it how he wrote it when I transcribed it. Dear Father Seraphim, well, you tell your wife and children St. Ambrose sent a prayer to them, and may you all be blessed always. Now, he was named Ambrose. He loves Ambrose so much, he calls himself St. Ambrose. It is just wonderful. He just loves St. Ambrose so much, he just calls himself St. Ambrose. And I'm not telling him anything's wrong with that. I think it's all right. So, I do all you say, and the other side want me back. But I want God to be my master, and I walk with Jesus and the Holy Spirit until my Lord comes back to get us. Well, I'll cut your letter short so you can rest yourself, because I know you get a lot done, and you got a lot of prayer, and that's a good thing. Well, until I see you again, take care. St. Ambrose, love you all. That's all I got for you. Prison ministry is life, brothers and sisters. I guess we have a few minutes. If you have questions, I'll do my best. If you don't, that's cool too. You don't have a question. She has a question.
What is it like just going to a prison? What is the atmosphere like?
The atmosphere is a little bit surreal because it's kind of normal. Except you're going, you know, gates are locking behind you and stuff. In the public places, things are more normal. But I've also been in the pods, you know, where the guys live. And that, it's just, it's sad to see people locked up. It's sad to, I don't know, it's just going into the place that I went for when the guy was in solitary confinement, that was the most creepy, most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. You know, it was like, we all know Death Eaters, right, from Harry Potter? It was like they were Death Eaters. It was like I was feeling my happiness sucked out of me as I was talking to him. I could feel his despair. I couldn't do anything about it. I could say, I love you. I could say, I'm praying for you. I could just see the despair in him, and I could feel it in the air. It's like I could literally touch it. But that's not the way most of the prison is. Most of it is disarmingly normal looking. But then the guys tell me stuff that they go through and tell me stuff they see. And prison is not normal. Not normal at all.
Do you visit county jails and federal prisons or just state prisons?
I have been to one federal prison, but my ministry is in state prisons. I have, my credentials are for the Texas state prison system. So I've been to state prisons.
Are the prison conditions like low or
miserable? Or yeah. You know, it used to be that in the old days, let's say 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you went to prison, you had to strap them on, which meant put on your boots tight, you were going to fight. You were going to fight for sure. If you're a white guy, you were going to fight probably four black guys, not all at once, one after another. If you're a black guy, you're going to fight four white guys. I'm not sure, Mexican guy, I'm not sure who they fought, but they fought somebody. And you were expected to fight. So it was a much more violent environment. And the food was worse, and I think that they didn't treat them as well. You can make a life for yourself in prison. You can work in the craft shop, and you can have a job. You can live pretty safely. Most of my guys haven't been in fights for years, decades in some cases. And yeah, so you can make a life for yourself. But there's stuff in prison that beats down on you mentally, and if you're not strong mentally, you lose your way. That's the hard part of prison. I've never gone to death row. I've dealt with about every sin that I can think of and some that I can't think of, but I haven't gone to death row. I guess I would. If I had to, I'd go to death row. It wouldn't be my first choice. Death row is people waiting to be executed. Yeah. And by the way, I was about to give you my opinion about death row, but in prison ministry, I try not to have too many opinions. I don't get mad about the administration. They're there in prison. I can't do anything about it. I don't have a helicopter to break them out. So, you know, that's what I'm dealing with. So I'm not mad about what happens to them in prison. Sometimes it hurts my heart. But, you know, I don't want to have an us and them mentality because that's not my job. My job is not to reform the prison system. My job is to care about people in prison. No more questions? One more? Do they wear uniforms? They wear all white uniforms that are made in the prison. And I dress just like this because that way everybody in prison knows who I am. Nobody mistakes who that guy in the dress is. Everybody knows me.
You wear your sandals too?
No. The only time I don't wear sandals is for work, when I work in this emergency room, and when I go to prison, because you have to have closed-toe shoes. Now, they don't make the women wear closed-toe shoes. It's not fair. But they make men wear closed-toe shoes. So that's the only time I don't wear sandals. I have to wear closed-toe shoes. All right? Anything else? I'm a nurse. Yeah. Yeah. A nurse and a priest. And a human. What's that? You know, that's a really good question. One of the ways I make time for everything, I'm going to answer it really seriously, is that I don't do everything. And that I've learned that what's really important is that I pray. I serve two liturgies a week, of course, Sunday and a weekday liturgy. And that keeps me alive. That gives me strength. And serve Malebin every week. That is how I keep going. I don't try to do everything. I'm always behind in letters. I'm always behind in everything. But I show up in prison once a week, and I write to them as best I can, and I pray the liturgy, and I pray for people before the altar. So I don't do everything. I used to try to do everything, and I failed miserably. So now I don't try to do everything. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm not absolutely perfect at it, but yeah, it does. And I've learned that that's more important than that I wrote letters or that I did this or that I did that. The priestly ministry is full of doing stuff, and we need to do things. I mean, somebody needed to organize this conference, right? You have to do stuff. But primarily, the priestly ministry is no different than what you guys should be doing. We should be experiencing God. We should be placing ourselves, dust and ashes, in God's presence. So I try to do that every day. So when I tell you guys to pray, I'm doing it. When I tell you guys to read the gospel, I'm doing it. I tell you guys to read the Psalter, I'm doing it. And I've learned, I can't say I knew, I always knew this. It wasn't like that years ago. And I had troubles. I had psychological troubles. I've learned that that's what's most important. So that's how I do everything. I don't do everything. I don't really do hardly anything, but I do pray. So,
when you baptize them in the prison, if they had not, like, if they weren't named after a saint, would you change their name? Like,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Would the prison records change?
No, the prison doesn't care anything about that. But I care about that. Never mind. My diptychs is that. I changed one guy's name to Barnabas. You know what Barnabas means? Mm-hmm. What does Barnabas mean? Anybody know? Nobody knows? But what does it mean? What does the name mean? Son of consolation. And this guy is like that. This guy is just, he really believes this stuff. He is a simple country boy too, but really smart. I named him Barnabas. I named other ones Innocent. So there is an innocent guy in prison, because I named one. John, for John of Kronstadt, and Ambrose. I didn't name him Saint Ambrose. He just took that name himself. Joseph? Yes, Joseph. Yes. I think that was his middle name. I'm not sure. And so he took that because his other name wasn't really a Christian name. If I ever, yes, yes, but not in prison. I would. I mean, if they wanted to. Sure.
Do you go to women's prisons?
I have not. Do I go to women's prisons? I have not. That hasn't crossed my path yet. I will. If somebody asks me to do it, I will. I will. Actually, I could go to 6 prisons right now, except for the fact that I only have so much of me. I can only split myself in about 2 or 3 pieces, and I don't have enough to go to 6 prisons, because I'd spend a whole day going to prison. But if I went to, I'd go to a woman's prison, absolutely. It's kind of a mystery to me. Every contact I've had, including OCPM, Orthodox Christian Prison Ministry, they don't really talk about women in prison very often. It's mostly men that are writing them. I don't know why that is. But I'd go to a women's prison, sure, absolutely. You ever find out about one in Texas, you tell me. Right? But hopefully not, don't write from inside the prison, okay? Write from outside it. Anybody else? All right. God bless you.